During the Second World War, the Germans used a shock and awe technique in order to be very aggressive in their campaign, especially against the United Kingdom, where they had their blitzkrieg strikes. And this morning is going to be a bit of a shock and awe. I'm going to have to move very quickly this morning. But if you don't get everything, that's okay. You don't need to get everything. And you can also get the CD if you ask, and you can listen to it again. We've been talking about evolution versus creation, or we might even say naturalism, that is trying to explain everything apart from God versus a biblical outlook. Because the underlying assumptions for the evolutionist is that God does not exist. And as we read from 2 Peter chapter 3, the world just continues on as it always has. And so they want to explain things by slow and gradual processes. That's why they need the billions of years. So this morning, I just want to look very briefly on the question of how old is the universe? And this is important because in order to make their system work, they have to have vast, vast amounts of time. In fact, I was saying to the youth, I don't think billions of years is even remotely close to the amount of time that they would need. To begin with, I think it's impossible. But to follow their mechanism, I think they would need trillions of years. I think that 13.7 billion years is a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of time that they would actually need if it were even possible to begin with. Now, we've been talking about this because we're seeing that studies are showing that people are walking away from the faith because of the science versus faith issue as they perceive it. Many of you have heard of Dan Brown. He was the man who wrote the Da Vinci Code, one of several books. And apparently many people left the faith because of that book, because it's actually fiction. It's supposed to be fiction masquerading as nonfiction, but it's not even a good book. But anyways, it became a movie. He sold more than 80 million copies of this book, 80 million. And people walked away. Well, he was interviewed a while after the book had come out, and then they had a movie that made like $700 or $800 million. But one of the questions he was asked was, are you religious? Here's Dan Brown's response. I was raised Episcopalian, and I was very religious as a kid. Then in 8th or 9th grade, I studied astronomy, cosmology, and the origins of the universe. Now, that sounds really precocious of him in 8th or 9th grade, the little tidbits he would have gotten. But anyways, he said, I remember saying to a minister, I don't get it. I read a book that said there was an explosion known as the Big Bang, but here it says God created heaven and earth and the animals in 7 days. Well, he doesn't even get his Bible right because God did it in 6 days. Which is right? Now, look at this. Not only did he not get his facts respond, which causes a problem, but look at the second response from our side. Unfortunately, the response I got was, nice boys don't ask that question. Our responses matter. Look what happened to Dan Brown. He said, a light went off, and I said, the Bible doesn't make sense. Science makes much more sense to me, and I just gravitated away from religion. Now, notice the term he uses. I gravitated away from religion, because that's all he views it as, is religion. So, while some of you might be wondering, why am I getting all this science stuff and this things in church? Because it matters in the real world. It really does. There won't be a church to go to if the church doesn't start dealing with this in the coming generations. Do you realize that more than 1,000 churches have closed down in England? Because there's no people going to them anymore. And the number one reason statistically is science versus faith. So we need to equip ourselves because young people are walking away and there's no good reason for it. Except we're too lazy to go out and equip ourselves to do this. It really comes down to that. because there's so much free stuff available that if you just shut the TV off and occupy your time with something productive, we could easily do this. And I would say this, if I can do it, anyone in this room can do it. Evidence confirms a young universe. That might seem strange to you, but actually they're not going to tell you all this stuff. And I'm just going to give you a smattering of a few things. There's some really good ones I'm going to omit because of time. There's one called the faint young sun paradox. In other words, the sun should have been much cooler in the past, which actually means that if you go back to when they say life form billions of years ago, the average temperature on Earth would have been below zero. And if that's the case, life wouldn't have formed because it would have been a frozen ice ball. So they have to come up with ways to try to get a hotter sun. And they can't. That's why they call it a paradox. And there are several others. The first one I want to talk about is the Earth's magnetic field. Now, I'm not going to make this too complicated, but the Earth is actually a giant magnet. So those rings that you see are actually pulses of electromagnetism coming out from the Earth. The Earth's a giant magnet. So you see here, you see a compass point. So the north is our north pole on our magnet. So you have a north and south pole on your magnet, a plus or a minus. And the Earth is a giant one of these. And it's a good thing that we have this. Because if we didn't have this, you and I wouldn't be around to know we had it. Because this actually blocks most of the solar radiation that comes from the sun that would destroy all of life. So if this wasn't here, we wouldn't be here. Now, why this is important is because since the 1830s, they've been able to measure how strong this is. Now, there's actually a few smaller magnetic poles. This is called the dipole, which just means there's two, a north and a south. But there's also other ones. They just call them multipoles, but they're insignificant compared to this one. So we'll just look at this and make it as simple as possible. When they've been measuring this, they've been measuring since the 1830s, and they've noticed that it's been going down and down and down and down and down. In fact, it's going down about 5% every century. Now, it doesn't go down 5% in the sense of 5% and then you have a little bit less. It's exponential, which means whatever the total is, 5% of that each century. So it actually accumulates faster. It actually goes a little bit slower. What this means when they've calculated it is that every 1,450 years approximately, the magnetic power is cut in half. So they estimate that about 100,000 years from now, we won't have it. Now, no problem for us. But when you go backwards in time, what it means is that every 1,450 years, it's going to double in power. Now, that seems like a good thing because it's going to keep more of the bad stuff out. The problem is that how you would create this magnetic field actually generates heat. And the calculations show, I don't know if you know how the Earth's made up, but in public school you taught that the Earth has the crust on the outside, this little thin layer. Then you have the mantle, and then you have the core, which is made out of an outer liquid core and then a solid inner core. Okay, easy enough, four parts. The magnetic field comes from the core, so the heat gravitates out. At about 10,000 years ago, according to the models, and they haven't been able to discredit them, the magnetic field would be so strong that the mantle would be completely melted. So we'd be sitting, instead of it being solid as it is now, it would be molten, which guess what that's going to do to the crust? You think the sidewalk gets hot when it's sunny out? The whole crust would be intensely hot. In fact, it may even vaporize over time all the water on the Earth. If you extrapolate it back to 30,000 years, then the entire crust melts. So the entire Earth is molten. So no life. It would be like lava, a big giant lava ball. And it would continue to do that. So this is really good, not for 6,000 years per se, although it fits perfectly with it. But this shows that the upper limit for this is 30,000 years. Evolutionists argue that our world is 4.6 billion years old. And life formed about a billion years at most after that. So life's been around for, say, 3.6 billion years. Life doesn't form on a blob of molten lava. They don't know what to do with this. So what they've done is they've created their own model that doesn't work with the data. They call it a dynamo. Now, for us, the word actually came from the UK, where they actually call generators dynamos. So think of it as a generator. And a generator just keeps producing heat, right? Or electric current, whatever it is. So yesterday we had the gas in the generator and it just continued to sustain it. So what they're arguing is that you have a dynamo, this generator, that basically runs out of energy, builds itself back up, starts itself back up, and it just keeps doing this forever and ever and ever and ever. To this day, they can't come up with a mechanism to make it work. All the computer simulations, everything, can't make such a thing work. It doesn't work. Yet the model that creationists are using, that it works perfectly. Now, let me show you why this is important. One, they can't make a dynamo work. So something that just sustains itself forever and ever and ever. They can't make it work. Which would eliminate the problem if they could, because it would just kind of reach a peak and go back and reach a peak and go back, and it would just continue on forever. Other planets in our solar system have magnetic fields as well. So if this theory works, then they should work on the other planets. They don't. In fact, one astronomer said that NASA should stop guessing or estimating because every time they're wrong and they're way off. Using this model, a creationist PhD physicist by the name of Russell Humphreys, he said, okay, in 2 Peter chapter 3, it says that God made the earth out of water and by water. So let us assume that the Bible is true and that God made the earth the way he did it, and molecules are magnetic by nature. Okay, just trust me on this. So molecules are magnetic. They'll have a north and a south on them. But usually what they do is when they line up, you'll have a north-south, a south-north, north-south, and they just cancel out each other. But his assumption was, let's say God created the world and he lined up the magnetic poles all in the same direction. You would create a very, very strong magnetic field. And that field would slowly decay. In other words, it's going to weaken over time. And this thing would last for several thousand years. So let's say 10, 20,000 years on its own. And an evolutionist can't debate this. This is well known. So as he says, okay, if my theory works, then it should work on all these other things. So back in the 80s, he made predictions. And so did NASA, because Voyager 2 hadn't got to Uranus and Neptune yet, the satellite that they unmanned spacecraft they sent out. And so he made predictions and he published them. So he put his neck on the line and say, okay, if the Bible works, then this is what it should be. So they got there, they measured Uranus, and then a little while later they measured Neptune. NASA was off by more than 100,000 times. When he made his prediction, he had narrow error bars, and the predictions fit right smack in the middle. He did the same thing with Mercury and Mars, and he did it. Now he's doing it stuff outside of our galaxy. He's done it with meteors. Every time it fits in there, and NASA is always off by about 100,000 times. NASA has even bigger problems, because in dynamo theories, because basically what they're arguing is that the outer part of the core is molten. They argue that it's spinning around a solid object, and that is creating electrical current. It's basically all this. You have a solid core that's not moving, you have liquid going around it, and it's generating electricity. The problem is, what way does the Earth rotate? It rotates like this, and the current should come, it should be lined up roughly with the rotation of the Earth. In some of the planets, you'll have the magnetic field going like this and the planet rotating like this. In the opposite, it's perpendicular. It's 90 degrees off. They can't explain this at all. It should be lined up. So, anyways, physics aside, this is a very, very, very strong argument against the universe being billions of years old. In fact, this puts upper limits on how old the universe can be, putting it in the 10 to 30,000 year old range, and they can't do anything, so they ignore the problem. They ignore it. If you go and Google it, you're going to find out that somebody's actually come out with a mathematical way to do this. The problem that they're not going to tell you is that two of the numbers they had to enter into the equation are about 10 times greater than the actual real numbers. They won't tell you that. But when they actually test it in laboratories and known numbers and they plug those numbers in, the system doesn't work at all. Okay, enough of that one. If you have questions, you can ask me later on, or I'd be happy to talk more about this. Another one is comets. All of us are familiar with comets like Halley's Comet, Hale-Bopp that went by, which was the largest comet that they'd ever seen. It's about 40 kilometers across the nucleus. So the actual comet itself is about 40 kilometers across. Comets come in two types, what they call short-period comets and long-period. So this is their rotation, how long it takes them to orbit around the sun. So I actually put the wrong numbers in here. I just noticed it. It's not 100 years. That should be 200 years for both of them. So 200 years orbits, and they go in prograde, which means they go the same way around the sun that all the planets do. So prograde means counterclockwise. You're taught this. If you stick your right hand thumb up, pointing north, and you curl your fingers go in the direction that it rotates. So don't ever say I'm not practical. Okay, an inclination means that the planets go around in a certain line around, and it's always based on the Earth. So the Earth becomes a flat plane like this. So it's like a level disk, and everything is judged based up or down on the Earth. So low inclination means they're close to the Earth. So all the planets are very close to the Earth's inclination by just a little bit. And these short ones are normally right in line. Halley's Comet's not. Halley's Comet's weird. It actually goes the opposite direction, actually goes clockwise. And it has a high inclination. But normally this is. And basically long period comets are longer than 200 years. Half them go one direction, half them go the other. And some of them go even up. So if we're going this way, they're going this way. So anyways, this is just how they categorize them. The reason this is important is because they believe that comets are the leftover debris from when the solar system was formed. So all this stuff is supposed to be the same age as our solar system, so 4.6 billion years old. However, because comets are described, Fred Whipple, who was not a... he was an evolutionist, described them as dirty icebergs. Basically, it's a ball of ice. Some of it is, most of it's water ice, but it's also different types, like frozen carbon dioxide is, what do they call that? Dry ice. It's made of that. Methane. It's different types of water. And then they call it dirty because it's got some dust particles in it that make it look dirty. A good illustration of this is... parking lot, you plow the snow. Springtime, is that snow nice and white? It's always that yucky brown color, right? So that's what these are like. They're like that leftover frozen parking lot stuff. Anyways, as they go around, they approach the sun. What happens to an ice cube when it goes by a source that's really hot? It begins to melt. In fact, that's why you can see these, and they look like these... long streams. The word comet, by the way, in Greek means long-haired. So they think it looks like long hair coming out. But that's it vaporizing as it going around. So what they're saying is these things can only go around a few dozen times before they're gone. So Estimates have been done to say that the longest longest possible orbit period, and what they're saying is that in maybe a couple of million years, and this is using evolutionary categories, after a couple of million years, there shouldn't be any comets left at all because they all would have vaporized. How can we see tons and tons and tons of comets? So they don't know what to do about this. So why don't we just invent some stuff? This is what evolutionists do, and they make it sound like science. So they've invented two different sources for comets because, well, the universe is billions of years old, right? We know that. So we'll just invent some information to make it work. So those little tiny yellow rings are supposed to be the orbits of the planet. So we're going way, way, way out. So one of the things they've invented is a donut-shaped thing way outside of Neptune, and they call it the Kuiper Belt. It's named after an astronomer whose last name was Kuiper. And they believe that this is the source of the short-period comets, so less than 200 years. Guess how much evidence there is for this? Now, if you say zero, you're actually wrong, but it's about this much. So there's a little bit, but they actually, a lot of people, they used to call them Kuiper Belt objects. Now they're actually changed the names to TNOs, Trans-Neptunian Objects. The reason for this is they found a bunch, but none of them look anything like comets. They actually look like planets or asteroids. One of those Trans-Neptunian objects you may have heard, it's called Pluto. Pluto is not a planet anymore. It's now called a TNO. And what they're finding is that they can actually measure the density of these things, so how jam-packed the material is together. What they found with comets, they actually took what they're calling a hammer, and they actually took a space object, put it out there, and they shot something at a comet and blew a big chunk off it. And then they were able to measure how dense it is, and they're really, really porous. They got a lot of holes in it. So basically they're saying is they don't even hardly know how comets are even holding themselves together. They're so fragile. Maybe this is a good way to explain it. Kids love making snowballs, right? You love when you were little, you go and you throw them at school and you get in trouble. You want the packing snow, right? Because you can jam it and it gets nice and hard. Now, what happens when you try to make a snowball when it's not packing snow? It's that light, fluffy stuff. You get it, and maybe a little bit of stick together, but it kind of just falls apart. Well, they thought that comets were like those packing snow balls. They actually found out they're like the other stuff that just wants to fall apart. More of it sticks to your mittens than it does to the center part. So when they measured the density of all these other objects in the so-called Kuiper Belt, none of them are anything close to comets. So they can't be comets. They're more like asteroids or they would be similar to moons and things like that. They're just these big rocks out there, ice and rock. So all the evidence that's coming in now is actually showing that what is in the Kuiper Belt isn't actually comets. In fact, they started using the Hubble telescope to look for these things, and they predicted a certain number, something like 85 they should find in a certain section. They should average out. And they're finding that what they're finding is about at most 10% of what they should find based upon their evolutionary age. Well, for the long period of comets, they know that the Kuiper Belt can't work physically for it. So a guy named Jan Oort, a Dutch, both these came up in the 50s, by the way. Jan Oort came up with the Oort cloud, which is way, way, way out. We can't see it. So that's really good for them. Because if you can't see it, you can't say it's wrong. Because they're putting it out there at least 10 to the 5th astronomical units, according to this. An astronomical unit is the average distance between the Earth and the Sun. Okay, so 150 million kilometers. 93,000 miles. Or 93 million miles is 1. So 10 to the 5th is a 1 with 5 zeros after it. So that's what, 100,000 average Earth-Sun distances. Now you'll notice here, at about between 10 and 10 to the second is where Neptune is. So we're way, 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 way past Neptune. So if these things are small, they can't see them. Well, they're finding massive, massive now amount of data that shows that the Oort cloud doesn't exist. It can't do what they want it to do at all. Because what they have to do is they have to find some way to get these things to fall in. Because you have them all fall in at the same time, who cares? In a short amount of time, they all burn up and they're gone. What they have to have is every few thousand years, one or two of them bump into the solar system and start going around. They just want this sphere of these things to just kind of hang out there. But the system doesn't work. It's broken. Okay, enough of that. Now, Carl Sagan, who is a friend of creation, if you know anything about Carl Sagan, he used to have a show in the 70s called Cosmos. He said the universe is all there ever is, was, or will be. He was a very hardcore evolutionist. And this is what he had to say in 1985. And the evidence hasn't changed. In fact, it's gone down, what there is. He said many scientific papers are written each year about the Oort cloud, its properties, its origin, its evolution. They make you think they have it figured out. Yet, there is not yet a shred of direct observational evidence for its existence. Now, does Fox tell you that? CNN? Okay, lunar recession. Here's another one. This one's easier to understand. The idea is that the moon is actually moving further away from the Earth. That's all lunar recession means. So each year, the moon is moving about 3.8 centimeters away from the Earth. Now let's roll tape in reverse, and we have a problem. Because at a certain period of time, the Earth and the moon are touching. And if they believe that the Earth and the moon formed roughly the same time, 4.6 billion years ago, and guess what? About 1.4 billion years ago, they're touching. Uh-oh. If you go on websites right now by evolutionists, they're scrambling on this. And this has been known for a long, long, long time. So the diagram is showing that the Earth is spinning this way and the moon is going around. And because each of them is a large object, they have a gravitational pull on each other. And as the moon goes around, when it's tugging on the Earth, it's actually pulling the water. That's why we get the tides we get. So Sarah and I, a few years ago, we went out to the East Coast and we went to the Bay of Fundy. And you can go down at the National Park and you can go down, you can walk around. We went down there in the evening and we were walking around on the ocean floor. And you can see the rocks are wet 40 feet above your head. Because 12 hours earlier, the water was that high. Twice a day, it goes up and down 40 feet. And the vast portion of the tides are caused by the pull of the moon on the Earth. And you get a bulge. In other words, it pulls and you get a bulge on the top and one on the bottom. And there's reasons for this. But the bulge pulls in this direction because the Earth is turning at the same time. And what that means is that the Earth then pulls the moon. And what happens is when it pulls it, it doesn't pull it towards it. It actually pulls it out. So it's 3.8 centimeters, it moves out. Now, they can figure this out. This is a picture, in case you think that they didn't actually go to the moon. This is the surface of the moon when the Apollo missions went in the 60s and 70s. They actually left some equipment on here. One, they had to leave the lunar part of the lunar landing so that they had less weight to try to get back out when they first went. But this is the only experiment from the Apollo missions that's still going on today. They left these things in the middle. They call them retroreflector arrays. And there's several of them. By the way, you can still see the footprints there. There's no weather on there, so the footprints are still there. They can actually look in telescopes and they can see these today even. Anyways, what they do with these things, and here's a close-up of it. And it kind of looks just like some weird thing, like a honeycomb. But actually, it's for laser ranging. What they do is they actually shoot a laser beam from on Earth and they can actually hit this thing. They actually compare it to somebody holding a dime up and somebody with a gun three miles down the road hitting it. That's how accurate these things are. And what they do is they've been taking measurements since the 70s on this, and they know within about a couple of millimeters that the Earth is moving, or the Moon is moving away from the Earth about 3.8 centimeters every year. So what they can do with this is they can use some math. Now, I put this up because we have some university students who are taking math, so they can analyze the equations there when they get bored. But anyways, they use the formula at the top, and because they don't want to write out large numbers, they use letters. They're just lazy. So they take a formula, they plug in all the numbers they know, and then they change the formula to the bottom one. T means time. So the formula, what it does, they know how fast it's moving away now, and they run it in reverse. And they can figure, okay, if we want to set time as zero, and they make it in distance, so when the Earth and the Moon are touching, how long would it take for that to happen? Well, they actually know that it actually speeds up over time, because as the Moon gets closer, it creates larger tides because it's pulling, which means that the Earth is going to fling it out faster. It's actually the inverse sixth power that it does it to. Okay, for our physics professor down in the front row here. Okay, so what they do is they calculate it, and the upper range here is 1.44 billion years. So they want it 4.6 billion, yet at 1.44, they're actually touching. Uh-oh. There's actually something called the Rausch limit. And what that is, they actually take a formula, and they can actually, because the Earth is much bigger than the Moon, when the Moon gets so close to the Earth, the Earth's gravity will actually rip it to shreds. And when you use the calculation at about 18,500 kilometers from the Earth, if the Moon came that distance, it would rip it to shreds. And we might get a ring like Saturn around it, because the Earth's gravity just overwhelms the gravity of the Moon that's holding it together. So in fact, when you put that number in, it means that it can only be 1.02 billion years old before it enters the Rausch limit and would be blown to bits. So what that means actually is that according to this, the Moon can't be any more, the Earth-Moon system, more than a billion years. Now that's a long way from 6,000, but what we're saying is the evolutionary scenario doesn't work at all. So we had one that showed 30,000 years. Now we have one that showed, by the way, we would argue that, yes, it's moving away, but God stuck it there 6,000 years, so it's only moved a few meters in that time, in 6,000 years. Big deal. By the way, they should be able to find evidence for this, if the Earth was significantly closer to the Moon in the past, because the waves, they'd have massive tidal waves that would be happening, and they would see it. Geologists would be able to find this, and there's none. Now, to be fair, we're going to end with this one. We can get a few pieces of information, the stuff that's available, and there are many, many more, that show that the universe can't be old like they say it is. Not even close. We're talking thousands of years, not millions or even billions. But, to be fair, is there anything that we have a problem with? And say, we got you Christians here. And there's one. This has been considered the number one difficulty that we have with dating. It's called the light travel time problem, or the distant starlight problem. Now, this is a picture called cosmic pearls. This is a supernova. A supernova is when a star decides to blow itself to bits. And a star, which is, there's about 100 billion of them in a galaxy, when it explodes, it gives off so much light energy that it'll actually be as bright as the entire galaxy for a few days, a few weeks, a few months. This one here is called 1987A because it was the first one found in 1987. It's in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is estimated to be 168,000 light years away. Light travels in a vacuum at a constant speed, 300,000 kilometers per second. So it's pretty fast. It takes about 8 minutes for the light to get from the sun to the Earth. Now, a light year is the amount of distance that light will travel in a year. So it's in the trillions of kilometers. This thing, traveling at the speed of light, it would take 168,000 years to get, when that photon of light leaves this supernova, to get to the Earth. Plus, the deep Hubble Deep Field can actually see things in the order of more than 10 billion light years away. If the Earth is only 6,000 years old, how can we see things that it would take the light to travel that distance? In other words, this thing should have blown itself up. Not in 1987, that's when we saw it. It should have blown itself up 168,000 years before 1987. Everybody following me? Put up your hand if you're following me. Light can only travel so fast. So in other words, traveling at a light year, light should, in 6,000 years, should only have traversed 6,000 light years. Anything beyond that should be black. We shouldn't see it because the light hasn't gotten here. Now all the hands go up? Okay, thank you. As I tell the young people, if you don't understand me, it's probably my fault, so let me know. And I'll try to explain it another way. So how do we deal with this? Can we solve this? Or are we just like the evolutionists? We'll just invent stuff. Well, some people invent stuff. Some say the distances are wrong. This doesn't solve the problem. One, because the distances are probably right. Astrophysicists who are creationists believe that the distances at most are 20% off. It's really tough to take something 10 billion light years away and compress that into 6,000 years. Okay, if you want to know, if you go online, I can recommend a paper for you and you can read about how they do this. It's really boring, but they can figure this out. So to argue that the distances are wrong, that doesn't solve the problem. Because even if you argue, because they can find things that are fairly far away with direct calculations called parallax. You just set up an angle and they can measure the distance. So this one they can't argue with. The problem is, God created the sun, moon, and stars on day 4, created Adam and Eve on day 6. When Adam and Eve opened their eyes, what should they have seen in the stars? I gave the answer. What should they have seen in the sky? Stars. So we don't have to get this in 6,000 years. We actually have to get this in 2 days. So changing the distances doesn't work because you'd have to have everything 2 days away. It doesn't work. Some have argued for what they call seed decay. So they put it in this. It's like Y2K, remember that? Okay, seed decay means that the speed of light, which is represented by the letter C, is actually been slowing down. So a British physicist by the name of Barry Setterfield has been trying to work on this. And if actually some secular atheist evolutionists are arguing that the speed of light is actually slowing down too. The problem is they're arguing that it's slowing down by like microseconds. This would have to slow down by at least a trillion fold. So not 186,000 miles per second, but multiply that by a trillion. So the idea is if it's going that fast, it can get here really, really, really fast. The problem is that almost all of physics in the equations to figure stuff out and understand it require us to know what the speed of light is. And if it changes, it changes everything else. And so this is not a good way to go, and there's no evidence for it. Now, let's look at some decent ones. Many people have argued, and maybe people in this room understand this, as what they call the light in transit view or the mature creation view. A PhD physicist by the name of Don DeYoung has argued for this in the last couple of years. What they argue is that because God made everything mature, so he didn't make Adam and Eve as toddlers, he made them as a grown man and a grown woman. He didn't make seeds, he made trees with seed-bearing fruit. So God made a mature creation, all ready to go. So it's called light in transit because they argue that God not only created the star, but the beam of light. Now, this makes sense, right? Here we go. We win. The problem is when you look at supernova and different things, they tell you information. So according to this view, we would have to argue that that actually wasn't a supernova. God just put pictures in the sky that we see because that object actually wouldn't be there. Just the beam of light would be there. And so most Christians have said this doesn't work because it kind of makes God look a little bit deceptive. because we're looking at this stuff and we think it's real, but it's not. Because God's just put pictures in the sky. He's just actually put beams of light with information that's not true. So I don't think this is a good way to go. And if you believe this one, you don't have any actual information to support it. This is just philosophy. This is a belief system. Okay. If you don't like the title, blame Jason Lyle because he gave it the title. So we'll call it ASC, Anisotropic Synchrony Convention. According to Einstein, when he came up with his general and special relativity theories, time is not a constant, and we'll get into this in a second. But Einstein said that actually the speed of light could be interpreted in two different ways. And that is, they cannot measure the one-way speed of light. This is why. Light travels so fast that in order to measure the one-way speed of light, in other words, for it to get to point A to point B, they would have to know what the speed of light is in order to make the calculation. Well, that's circular reasoning because you're trying to figure out what that is to begin with. So when they actually measure the speed of light, they actually have to bounce it off something, a mirror or something, and bring it back, and they divide by two. Because you use one object that you calibrate, you bank it off, you divide by two, so you know the distance between, and you want to know what it is at one distance, so you divide by two. Now, Einstein said that that's true, but he said that you don't know whether it goes the same speed in both directions. And this actually fits with relativity, so this may seem arbitrary to you, but as far as relativity theory is concerned, taking the two-way speed of light and dividing by two is arbitrary. They're choosing that as a convention. Anisotropic synchrony convention, which works fine. The people who don't like this say, we don't like it on philosophical grounds. We can't prove it wrong. Okay, so if this doesn't sound good to you, it's not because the science is wrong. What Lyle argues is that the speed of light in one direction is infinite, but it's not in the other direction. Now, what this would mean is that it has to do with the observer, has to do with the speed of light. And what he's observing is that that star is sending the starlight to us at an infinite speed. So it gets here instantaneous. I don't like this because it doesn't seem rational to me. But if it doesn't make sense to you, that's okay. That's on philosophical grounds. But nobody can prove this wrong. They will never, ever, ever, ever be able to prove this is wrong because there's no way to test it. But what he's arguing is that, yes, those things are way out there, but it takes the starlight an instant to get here. Yet, it would take 186,000 miles per second in total, the two-way distance. So it means, you understand me? Yeah, I think it's wrong anyway, so we'll just move on. Okay. I'm spending time with this, so if it's over your head, we'll work on it. The thing is, this is the one that they're going to say to you, and you're going to go, And young people are going to hear this, and they're going to go, the Bible can't be true. Because you're right. Those things are billions of light years away. So the universe must be billions of years ago. Case closed. Two physicists. Both of them are, I would put, in the realm of geniuses. But Russell Humphreys has... Okay, according to relativity theory, so this is the view of physics that came about with Einstein. Before that, we had Newtonian physics. Now we have relativity theory, which kind of takes Newton's view of physics and takes them at extreme speeds and extreme distances. Okay, he viewed... For instance, he's the one that was able to explain space and gravity by showing that actually gravity warps space. It actually changes space. And this was actually proven when they looked at an eclipse of the sun. And they actually could see that the light was bending. And it actually proved that relativity theory in this case was true. So what this argues is that according to Einstein, time doesn't go at the same speed everywhere. To us, it's always the same. But you take an atomic clock and you put it at sea level. You take one, you put it on a mountain, and they don't tick at the same speed. So time actually goes faster on top of the mountain. You will never know, but it's actually when they calibrate the clocks and they line them up, it actually ticks faster on the mountain and slower down low. For instance, you have a GPS. They have to calibrate the atomic clock that's on the GPS because it's even further away from the Earth's center of mass, and so it ticks even faster. So gravity affects time. So if you had zero gravity, it would speed it up. More gravity, slow it down. So what Russell Humphreys argues is that the Earth is in what's called a potential well. In other words, the Earth is in the center of the universe, and the most, because the most of the mass tends towards the center, that time goes really, 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 really slow here, and it goes really, really, really fast the further out you go. Everybody following me? So while from Earth clocks, 6,000 years has gone by the clocks way, way outside of the gravitational well, they're going really, really fast. So in this view, billions of years actually has gone on way, way, way out there. But from here, only 6,000 years goes by. This works as far as physics is concerned, and this fits in with the Bible as well, because the Earth is the center of reality from the biblical perspective. A better view is by John Hartnett. He also argues that speed, according to Einstein, speed goes. In other words, time would actually come to a standstill if you were traveling at the speed of light. So time would stop at the speed of light. So if something expands very rapidly, if it's going really, really fast. In other words, if you took a clock and you put it on some object that was traveling at the speed of light, the hand would never move. It would stop. And as you're approaching the speed of light, it's not going to stop. It's going to go really, really fast. So what Hartnett argues is the Bible says like a dozen times that God stretched out the heavens. So in Job, Psalms, and other passages, it talks about God stretching out the heavens. And what he argues is that stretching of space when God stretched it out would actually affect time. And since the Earth is in the center, the Earth isn't moving, but as God's stretching out space, it's carrying along everything with it. And so God, when he sets the sun, moon, and the stars out, he goes like this, whoosh, stretches the space out, and guess what it does to time? It's going a zillion-fold faster than on Earth. So you have time for the light to get here during the stretching period. And this all works on paper, all of it. So let's end with this part of, as far as this, because none of us are going to understand all the physics involved in this. But what we're saying here is that we have plausible solutions. None of these may turn out to be right, and they're actually working on some new ones as well. But what we're saying is that this isn't insurmountable because there are good ways that we can answer this question. So when somebody comes to you and says, well, how can we see light that's thousands of years or millions or billions of years away in 6,000 years? Well, I'm not sure, but I know that there are ways that physicists are able to explain this. And if they're interested, then you can point them to the information and they can find it. So this is all I want to get out of you this morning is to say, listen, if somebody says that, don't let your jaw hit the floor and have no idea what to do. Know that while I don't understand them, people are able to respond to it in physics. They're not inventing stuff, which is what the evolutionists have to do. They have to invent stuff like dark matter, dark energy, an Oort cloud, all stuff that there's zero evidence for. These relativistic ones in the anisotropic synchrony convention is using the same physics that all the evolutionists are using. The same stuff. They're not appealing to a God of the gaps thing. They're just saying, well, a miracle. Every time we don't understand something, we just plug a miracle in. No, we're saying the same physics shows it's possible. So just point them to the resources. But it's a young universe, folks. They're not going to tell you this. By the way, they're finding more and more and more evidence for it. They're sending stuff around Jupiter and things, and they're analyzing the moons there and Saturn. And these things should be cold and dead. By the way, they've recently found that there's like earthquakes and stuff going on the moon. And it's coming from the core, which means that it's geologically active. They said that the upper estimate is 2.5 billion years that it could stay geologically active. So according to their own theory, it doesn't work because there shouldn't be any of this going on. Jupiter and some of the other planets are giving off twice as much energy, and if not more, than what they're taking in from the sun. After billions of years, how are these things still shooting out energy? They should be cold and dead. You got small moons that are erupting nonstop. Where's the heat energy coming from? It should have been dissipated. It should be gone. Yet they're finding this over and over and over and over again. But they're so biased, they will never, ever, ever tell you any of this information. Cordy lent me two videos that I would highly recommend. And maybe, Cordy, is it okay if we lend them around? A guy named Spike Saras has done videos. And basically what he's done is he's showing you evidence and he's quoting from all these secular scientists who actually, when they admit there's problems, it's called What You're Not Being Told About Astronomy. And there's two videos and they're fantastic. He's a likable guy. He used to work for NASA. He's an engineer who worked for NASA. And one's on the solar system, one's on the galaxies. And he's just quoting these guys, showing how, according to this, this planet shouldn't even exist. And according to this, so if you're interested, let me know and we'll pass them around. It's eye-opening when you actually see what even the evolutionists are saying. Some recommendations here, if you want. For the physicists, I recommend the book by John Hartnett, Starlight Time and the New Physics, where he goes through the second half of it's all equations. So, Rosie, if you get really bored, you can read all the appendices. But he argues for the one, the expanding creates it, and he completely supports his model. He uses a different type of physics than what most people normally. This is called a five-dimensional physics. Normally, we talk about four dimensions. So we have length, width, depth, and we have time. This one has actually the expansion of space he puts in it, because we know space is expanding. And this was actually invented by an unbeliever, an Israeli physicist, by the name of Moshe Carmeli. And Hartnett has published paper after paper after paper in the scientific secular literature proving his theory works. And none of them have been able to undermine it whatsoever. Taking Back Astronomy is a popular level book. Beautiful pictures in it by Jason Lyle. It's got a little section on this and a bunch of other problems. And everyone in this room, I would heartily recommend you read a book by Jonathan Sarfati. He's the gentleman that came here that spoke when we had him. This is a book. It's about yay thick, called Refuting Compromise. And he goes through all kinds of stuff. And it's fantastic. It's worth the read. We have several copies at the church that we purchased. So if you want to commit yourself to spending some time reading through it, he puts all the hard stuff in footnotes so you can skip it. Or when he gets to something really hard, he just says skip over to page such and such if you don't understand it. But this book was written for us. Okay, and what he's arguing against is a man named Hugh Ross, who actually is a Canadian astronomer who's trying to tell people, he has a ministry called Reasons to Believe, that we should believe in God and the Bible, and yet we should believe in the Big Bang and in billions of years and all that. And he absolutely rips them to shreds and says, you can trust the Bible. I recommend this book enthusiastically. And here's some good websites. You can go to creation.com, which is Creation Ministries International. That's who Jonathan Sarfati works for. Answers in Genesis with Ken Ham. They have popular level stuff and technical stuff. So for the layperson, you can go to Creation Magazine. You can get a subscription, or Answers Magazine, or you can go get their Creation Technical Journals, and you can read it, which is peer-reviewed, which means atheists can write in and critique their stuff. It's, in other words, experts have to read these and approve them before they're published. But most of this stuff you can read online for free. Free stuff. Over 7,000 free articles on creation.com alone. ICR is the Institute for Creation Research. Many of you have probably heard of Henry Morris. Wrote a famous book, it was in the late 63, called The Genesis Flood, him and John Wickham. He started this ministry with Dwayne Gish, Institute for Creation Research. His two sons run it now, but they have a bunch of free stuff. They have a wonderful magazine I get. You can just subscribe for it free. It's called Acts and Facts, popular level stuff. Fantastic. Free. Apologetics Press is out of the States, and they write stuff on everything. Islam, but they have a bunch of PhD scholars that work for them, a bunch of free books. You like free? There's a bunch of books by a man named Bert Thompson. He's got a real sad story, unfortunately. But there's a bunch of free books there that are written for us. And there's if you write down the last website, trueorigin.com, there's a man named Ashby Camp who's actually compiled a list of about 1,400 resources, and he's put the links, and they're all on top, and you just click on it and opens the page. So you don't even have to do any work. So if you just go there. So these are for those who want more information. What I would recommend is keep this stuff on file. You don't have to go out and research every topic, but somebody comes to you and says, what about distant starlight or the light transit problem? What are you going to do with that? Well, you go home, you boop, boop, boop in these websites, and voila. All your information right at your fingertips. If you go to Answers in Genesis, there's a link called Media. You click on it, Video on Demand. There's like 100 videos you can watch. So if you don't like to read, but you like to sit in front of your computer, you can watch videos on this stuff for free. But instead of watching your TV shows that are sucking the brain cells out of your head, why don't you feed your brain, get some good information in there, equip yourself, and away we go. Do you understand why this is so important? It doesn't seem very important. Like, what's this have to do with the Bible? I come to church, I want to, Pastor, feed me from the Scriptures. Hold up here. The Great Commission says, go into the world and make disciples. If the number one stumbling block is this, let's equip ourselves to go out and answer this question. Because if we don't, when we tell them the gospel, they're going to go, yeah, right. Expect me to believe the Bible? I told you the story. I dropped my van off a few years ago, and they gave me a shuttle ride to the church. And a guy picked me up, took me. Oh, what kind of church? You one of those fundamentalist people who believe that the earth is thousands of years old, God created it seven days ago? And I'm thinking, amen to that, I am. But there's an open door. There's an open door. Just equip yourselves. Doesn't mean you have to quit your job and stay home and lock yourself in your study. You know, just on this topic alone, you watch two videos, and you at least got enough information. Or the person asks them, lend them the video. Get them, buy them a subscription to Creation Magazine. Give them the website. If they're actually those who are inquiring, they will go. And by the way, Answers in Genesis and especially creationministries.com, if they have a question, they can submit it by email and they'll actually respond to them. The universe fits the biblical scale. And by the way, the reason we argue for 6,000 years is because the Bible puts genealogies in chapter 5 and chapter 11 that work very strangely. They say when so-and-so was so many years old, he had a son. And when that son was so-and-so years old, such and such, he had a son. You just add up the dates. And it comes to about 6,000 years old for the earth. If you want to add a few genealogies, okay, go ahead. I don't know why you would, but if you were, maybe we expand it out to 10,000 years. But 10,000 years versus 13.7, how do you get from that to that? If you trust the Bible, because if you're going to fit all that in, then I want to ask you one simple question. What is the purpose of the genealogies then? If we're missing billions of years in the genealogies, why were they written? Please tell me. Do you trust the Bible? And if you trust the Bible and you want to fulfill the Great Commission to tell people about Jesus, you have to get into their world, into their mind, and understand where they're coming from. And they're thinking 13.7 billion years old. They're thinking 4.6 billion years old. They're thinking evolution is true. Scientists have proven it. We've descended from ape-like creatures. The fossil record shows it. Noah's flood was a local flood, if it happened at all. They've been programmed by the world to believe all this stuff as fact, and it's a house of cards, and you just go, boop, and the whole thing crumbles. It's all tied together. Now, I know I'm out of time, but let me end with this. They have a series of assumptions how they view the world. One of them is that there is no God. So they're trying to explain everything they see, everything they know, without the existence of God. They're also assuming what's called naturalism. And that is, not only is there no God, but miracles and things are impossible. And only things that physics can explain, time, matter, energy, space, are allowed into the discussion. They also believe in uniformitarianism, which is the 2 Peter 3, that the processes always are the same. And so whatever we observe today, that's the exact way that things happened billions of years ago. So they outlaw things like a global flood. Now, since we're talking about astronomy a bit today, it's interesting that they're demanding there's a flood on Mars where there's zero liquid water, and yet they won't believe that there was a flood on the Earth where there's 73% of the planet is covered in water, and if you flattened all the mountains and raised all the valleys, we'd have 3 kilometers of water covering the entire Earth. Yet there was a flood, a global flood on Mars where there's zero liquid water, but there can't be one on the Earth which is covered in it. Do you see that they have agenda? Do you see that they have a mind block? So if you just go up there and said, you know what, Jesus Christ died on the cross for your sins, that's a fairy tale to them. You may as well start talking to them about the Easter Bunny or about Santa Claus, because it's just as real to them. Anyways, I hope you understand that the reason I'm going through this is that this is so, so important. We've got young people at the back, and some of them, bless the Lord, have gone through Christian schools. But some of them, from the time they get into kindergarten to the time they graduate from university, how many thousands of hours have they spent in those educational institutes being programmed by the same mantra day after day after day after day? And now they're influencing them with their ethics, where they're teaching them about same-sex relationships, and they're teaching them to be pro-choice as opposed to be pro-life. All these things when they're in primary school. It all begins with Genesis. Genesis tells us about how the world was created. It tells us about God. It tells about how sin entered into the world. It tells us about the consequences of sin. And even tells about us of God's promise to bring salvation. If we cast off this is not true, why should we believe in the resurrection? Why should we believe in Christ's death as an atoning sacrifice for our sins? Where do we choose what's true and what's not? Let me say this, folks, and I promise this is it. It's either true or it's not. If you don't believe it's true, then what are you doing? If you don't believe it, what are you doing? It's a nice day, go golf. This is the Word of God. And as Christians, we need to believe it from page one until the last page. Every word. And by the way, Jesus believed in a young earth creation. He really did. He described that Adam and Eve, marriage was from the beginning of creation. If we believe this to be true, then that demands we believe in a young earth. And it means that we better be able to equip ourselves to be able to tell people the truth of the gospel. Now, I'm not saying you have to believe in a young earth to be saved. Mm-mm. Jesus saves. But if this is a stumbling block, let's tear down that barrier. But let's care enough to actually equip ourselves. Father in heaven, we thank you that you have not left us in darkness, but you have given us a mind to be able to worship you with. you've equipped us, Lord, that we are able to discover just by studying the universe, both macroscopically and microscopically, that indeed the heavens declare the glory of God. And yet, Lord, the evil one and the sin nature and the world have blinded people into this delusion whereby they believe that all things have come into existence by themselves out of nothing. They would rather believe that which is illogical and irrational and unfounded than to acknowledge their Creator. Because if they've been created by God for God, then they are accountable to God. And Lord, their sin will not allow that. But Lord, there are many people who are blinded that are longing to know the truth. May we bring the light of the gospel to them. Lord, may we stop being lazy and not caring and too preoccupied by things that don't matter and really get serious. Because souls are at stake. And the church for generations has done nothing. We have become a stumbling block to the gospel. We are a hindrance to souls rather than a lifeline. May that change today, this very moment. May we do what you have called us to do, to give an answer for the faith that we hold, for the hope that we have in Jesus Christ. So, Lord, I pray that you would change our hearts and that you would use us and that we'd be faithful to that calling. In Jesus' name, amen.